spending has been seriously addressed in this budget, and it at least gives one a feeling that what one raises at some point gets taken seriously. And that's also a very strong message going out to the departments who reports specifically to our committee. It's interesting that most of the issues that the Minister of Finance raised, consultants, renting of venues, accommodation, are all issues that this committee has raised as well. Big delegations. So, well done, I think. Okay, let's continue. Page 43 at the bottom, application for registration. We're starting there. Is there any feedback that you want to give us on any issues that we discussed prior to adjourning for lunch?
Chair, I had a discussion at lunchtime with National Treasury on the investment fund, and they said that it might be a good idea to put it in the bill because they are also looking into it themselves, the Accountant General.
I also say it's also one of the recommendations in the committee's PRR report for CIRA. We're actually asking the Auditor General to audit that fund as one of our recommendations. We haven't adopted the report yet, but it is one of our recommendations that we will put forward in the report as well. Okay, so there's no problem, with other words, for us to put that fund in here. Good. Glad to hear. Let's continue then. Commissioner Jacobs, over to you.
Thanks, Chair. On page 43 at the bottom, application for registration. I'll just start with the first part there, Chair 1, 21.1. An application for registration as a security service provider must be made to the authority in the prescribed manner and must be accompanied by. And dear Chair, then I want to go to B, the application fee as determined by the council. B, A is inserted, a certified copy of a valid identity document of a person referred to in paragraph A. B, a design of the security service provider's insignia, emblem, title or symbol, whether on a uniform, vehicle or otherwise. And then see any other document or certificate required in terms of this act or by the authority to be submitted with an application for registration.
Is it the place where we talk about in the uniform? Is this this paragraph where we talked about the uniform and so on and so forth? Where you find that some security, well, some of the private securities are wearing uniform which is similar to the South African National Defence Force and others. Is it the same chapter?
I think it can be accommodated here. We're talking about the insignia on the uniform here,
yes,
what we wanted to put further than just the insignia is also the uniform itself, because there are too many uniforms out there from private security companies that looks like specifically the field clothes of SAPS, the operational clothes of SAPS. So you've got a BB, where it says, design of the security provider's insignia, emblem, title or symbol, whether on a uniform, vehicle or otherwise, we also believe that we should make provision for example of the uniform as well.
Chief, I could just respond on that. It actually forms a part of a bigger picture. We are also addressing the issue in the regulations. But this is specifically to ensure that when the company is registered, that we will be in a position to actually decide whether we will allow the emblem, etc. But in the regulation part, there's very specific provision on the prescribing the type of uniforms, etc., that may be used, Chair.
We take the point that we still believe, even if it's just a photograph of the uniform that is submitted together with the application, so that you can intervene at that point in time already and say to them, no, this is too close to what SAPS is wearing, or it's too close to what the Defence Force is wearing, therefore we would like to see you change it. So at registration point already. Doesn't mean the provisions in the regulations need to change. It can still remain there, but we think it would be good if we can include it here. Thanks for reminding us, Honourable Ndlovu. Will you make provision for that, please?
Through Chairperson, does this include the vehicles too? Why I'm sticking to this thing is because you recall that a month ago where you found that they called for the similar Malibazek asked the question to the police that they find the vehicle which is similar to the police and so on and so forth. Does this apply to the same thing again? Because we have to make sure that people are not doing one the same thing, only to find that they are intimidating the customers or the people who are getting benefit out of the service providers.
Yeah, I think that it refers to this insignia on the vehicles, but maybe again the same arrangement can apply. They don't have to send you a photo of a pre-designed vehicle, but they can send you graphics of it and say this is how it's going to look. Because I can tell you that there's a security company in the area where I stay that every morning, if it wasn't for the fact that they were using white lights instead of blue lights, you would think it is the police. And if you dare to come near them, they put on the lights and the siren. So can we put it in here as well? I think it's a valid point. Let's make provision for uniform and vehicle marking. So it's not only, we understand each other, it's not only the insignia, they must also say this is where we're going to put it, this is how it's going to look. Honourable Malabati?
Chairperson, talking of the lights, where do we put in the lights issue? Because some vehicles come, they look so much like police vehicles and so on. Where do we accommodate that? Thanks, Chair.
Chairperson, the issue about lights is actually addressed in the Road Transport Act, where you have prescriptions on the yellow lights, the blue lights, all the different types, and they are offences. One of the issues that we've been battling for quite some time is to get an offence for possession of blue lights, for example, but it need to be addressed in that specific piece of legislation. But the use of blue lights is actually just is restricted to the South African Police Service and I think the military police, and of course the Metro Police.
Can we just get the indication, Mr. Toki, what is the colour of lights that private security companies are supposed to be using?
Chairperson, there is no regulations that addresses those colours.
See, but that's a problem. That's a serious, serious problem. And I'm not saying that we must deal with it in the Act necessarily, but it definitely needs to be dealt with in regulations at least. Because I'm asking that question because that was my feeling, because you see that some of them with yellow lights, some of them with orange lights, white lights, blue lights even. So it becomes a problem. Secretary?
Jay, can I request that we also just go back to the Transport Act on that, because I know it was an issue about 4 or 5 years ago and there were prescripts in the Transport Act that affect the private security companies because they were asking for permission at that point to bypass the Transport Act and it wasn't granted. So before we say there are no, can we just go back to the Transport Act and check that and come back to you tomorrow morning?
I have a problem with what you're saying, because I asked the executive director, who should know.
Chairperson, I thought the question was whether the SIRA legislation makes provision for those regulations.
Mr. Chowke, the question was quite clear. What is the lights that are allowed to be used by private security companies? And you were saying there's no limitation from your side on it. And it can't be right.
Chair, I think especially when lights are what they call intermittent, that is specifically regulated, and the only lights that may be used are in terms of the Road Transport Act. So if a private security company do have blue lights or red lights or whatever, it will be in contravention of the Road Safety Act.
Well, then I think you can just about arrest every single one of them currently operating, because they all have lights that goes on and off, and it's all these colors that I'm giving you now.
Then we have a problem, Jefferson. Maybe they should look at the lights very carefully, because if the answers are not very good, because they are giving us a very big fright. We have a problem of lights outside here. People can bump you outside the road and so on and so forth, only to find that it's just a security company. It's not even the police and so on and so forth. You will never know exactly, really.
I would suggest that you go and have a look at it in terms of the Road Traffic Act. But I do believe whatever the Road Traffic Act says is not a problem that we find somewhere for it in this act as well, to repeat it. Even if it means we just refer to the relevant section within the Road Traffic Act. Can I also ask the question, what happens currently if we put in all of this and there are companies who are registered and are using these things in contravention of what we then pass?
In respect of just repeating the provisions of the Road Transport Act, it's already an offence to use it. So I don't think in that regard it should be a problem. It's maybe if you prohibit something that's widely used and it's legal. But in this regard, I think by just repeating what's in other legislation, it could not be any problem, Chair.
I don't think it's answering your question, because what will happen, my company is using, I'm just making an example, a yellow light.
And is wearing a uniform similar to such?
Similar, it's recognized, it's registered and everything. And the chairperson asked, what will happen then tomorrow when this bill is passed? Will I reapply again for the lights and so on and signal? What will happen? That's what she's asking, I think so.
Chair, and I appreciate the problem in that regard. There were actually draft regulations on uniforms, etc., for security officers, which was, I think, considered some 6 or 8 years ago. And it was some of the practical issues that prevented them from being issued at the time. And it is so, if you have a huge company using uniforms, etc., and suddenly that uniform is outlawed, it will have financial implications, etc. So I think that is why it was important that we have a system where, as companies register and re-register and etc., that we have a system that you can actually lay down some of these rules in terms of when they start off, that they start off on the right foot. But I can imagine that, especially with uniforms, it can have a huge financial implication. But if it was in contravention of a law, say for instance a police a uniform that resembles a police uniform, then you could say, no, well, it was already prohibited to be used. But if it's saying, for example, all camouflage uniforms, there's a lot of security companies using camouflage uniforms. Some of them blue, some of them darker colors, etc. But it will have financial implications, Chair.
You see, my problem is because, yes, you are quite right, the company will already be in contravention. But the fact is, CIRA allowed them. That's the bottom line. CIRA allowed them. And if I'm the company owner, I'm going to say, to hell with you. You've allowed me. This is what it's going to cost me to change this. And that is where CIRA is failing us currently. Mr. Stuber.
Chair, I don't think you can disqualify any private security company for having a certain type of uniform at this stage, prior to, even after the new law comes into being. I think what should happen is that in future applications must be to a certain standard that is being determined by them.
But it's already in the Act. The problem is they haven't applied it.
Yes, but Chair, you're gonna get lots of problems if you say now to private security companies, listen, you must change your logo and your attire and your apparel and everything that goes along with it. You will end up in court with them. We can't do that. That's not how we must regulate this Act.
We're not trying to do that. We're trying to determine what the consequences are going to be of what we're saying. Secretary?
I think that you could look at putting a provision into the transitional provisions that actually addresses what Honourable Member Stube is saying, where you can actually, you'd have to carefully word it, but you could put something into the transition.
Yes, but that's exactly why I asked the question. Because the fact of the matter is there are companies in contravention, but they're not necessarily in contravention because they're being malicious. They're in contravention because CIRA allowed them to be in contravention. And the point is we will have to move to a point where we say to CIRA and them, get your house in order. Wait, Mr. Stube, I'm not arguing with you, I'm agreeing with you. And what we need to do is to make provision for it and say your next round of buying uniform, you've got to start phasing it out. And it's got to be out of a 3-year or 5-year period in terms of that. And we must be careful, because that is the problem that we have, is that the security company will simply make that the responsibility of the individual security officer.
Chair, just for clarity, and I don't know, please help me out here. Is there an act that states that you can only use a blue uniform or a brown one? Or I know there was an act that prohibited you to use a camouflage uniform. I don't know whether that act is still there, but is there an act, and can we look into that act?
Can you just respond to that, please?
Chair, there has been legislation in place for many years protecting the specific pattern of camouflage that's being used by the South African National Defence Force and by the South African Police Service Task Force. But that's very specific patterns, and if I remember correctly, there was even a colour pattern of the camouflage published in the Gazette on those two. But other types of camouflage is not regulated. You can buy it in any store, you can wear it, etc.
Okay, but the question was more in terms of your other uniforms. With other words, your blues, the field blues.
Chair, relating to the police service uniform, if it resembles to a very large extent the police uniform, it is possible in terms of Section 68 to prosecute a person. But once again, you will have to prove that there was quite an overlap in terms of the uniform that's being used and the resemblance with the police service uniform.
Okay, and can I just say the lights is blue subs and military police. Green lights, emergency and disaster management. Red, ambulance and fire department. Orange, breakdown, heavy vehicles, building vehicles. And orange is one of the most popular lights that the private security companies are using. Why?
There's no.
So maybe we should go the route of the white. Yes.
Just another thing, construction vehicles is also orange. I mean,
I think, Chairperson, let us look on the transitional period and then discuss it lengthily on a transitional period so that we'll find a time and a place how we are going to make sure that all the companies, through CIRA, will implement this thing, because it's a very, very worrisome.
But it doesn't take away from what we're saying, that in the main Act, we put in the uniform requirement, but we put in a transitional arrangement for that as well. Okay, agreement?
This is our chair.
Yeah, lights as well. But, I mean, lights, as Commissioner Jacobs said, lights is already governed. And the fact of the matter is the cost of lights is not similar to the cost of a big security company changing their uniforms. So, you know, there you can be a bit more stricter in terms of it, because there's already an existing act and they're already transgressing that act. Okay, so can you just add those that we've talked about? Honourable Mulabot.
Yes, sir, thanks. And what about Metro Police? I know it's not part of this, but what about them and their uniform? I know there is a Metro Police in Western Cape that their uniform is 90% like SAPS. What about it?
Jenna, I think the Metro Police, I don't know in terms of registration and so whether the uniforms are actually registered, but I appreciate that there might be some of them, a lot of them are khaki, but I know in the Western Cape they look very much similar. But I mean the insignia on the badges, etc., is quite distinct from the police one.
That is dealt with under the SAPS Act, and it's part of the provisions. When you apply to be a Metro, you actually have to follow certain procedures which are approved by the National Commissioner, and that includes in the submission, because I know we had one last year that came through, it includes your uniform, what your vehicles are going to look like. All of that information has to be signed off by the National Commissioner, and it's currently regulated under the SAPS Act. So if they are similar, then it means it's been approved by the National Commissioner.
Yeah, so as much as CIRA fails us on this private security industry, then the National Commissioner who signed off on that failed us in terms of Metro Policing. Because insignia is insignificant. And I'm not talking, before anybody gets excited, about the Western Cape Metro. I'm talking in general similarities. Insignia is quite insignificant. If you get stopped on the road by somebody wearing a blue uniform, you don't know before you face the person what the insignia on that uniform is. You don't know. And many of these private security companies specifically have insignia very close to the police's. It's a star. It's got more sides than the star, but it's a star. So let's carry on. I think we've dealt with that issue.
Thank you, Chair. Then on page 45, renewal of registration 22, there's no amendment. Requirements for registration 23.1.
Just before you quickly, renewal of registration, under what circumstances would you renew? Every? Why are we keeping it weak? Why are we not putting conditions in the Act for renewal? Because that can also address some of the problems that we've just raised.
Yeah, I think we would also need to hear from CIRA on this, because the reason why it was put into the Act like this was, at the time the Act was drafted, was because of the costs, and CIRA was going to have to prepare for that renewal. So we just, and so it was going to be prescribed in regulation. The Act was going to enable the Minister. So I know there's been a lot of discussion about renewal, and it was one of the things we wanted to insist on, was that a company renew, because it's one way of criminally checking everybody again. So maybe we could just hear on whether CIRA has the capacity to do it at this point.
Mr. Choki. No, they don't fall, create a critical post, so they don't have the capacity. But Mr. Choki, respond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The regulations were prepared some 3-4 years ago, and they were published for comments regarding the renewal of registration. And I'm informed that the industry was up in arms regarding those regulations, and also the trade unions, because they saw it as a way of getting rid of security officers. And the other issue that was raised was the cost that would be incurred in terms of the infrastructure to be put in place before you can re-register all security officers. So those regulations has not been published as we speak, Madam Chair.
Honourable Stubbe, Honourable Kulabana.
Chair, I think what I don't know what we must understood under periodic application. If we can get a definition of that will be fine. Because I honestly, you either
apply and to start up a business, and not even for 5 years. It's not, nobody is going to say, I'm just going to be a security company for 3 months or 4 months. And honestly, I think that should actually be scrapped, because what periodic is there? Thank you.
But that's one awesome question. Yeah. Clarity on this issue. I'm not necessarily in agreement that we don't need renewals. I think renewals is always a good thing to have, but it needs to be sensible renewals. Ms. Kuhler-Bonnet?
Yeah, I think, considering the chaos that this entity has been in, and considering that they put their fees up, I think one lot was up 900%, and one it had borne no relation whatsoever to Treasury guidelines, that was being challenged. So to suggest now that the companies must go when? I mean, no, they can't even cope with what they've got now. So I think leaving it for the future, there's no way we can pass something now to say you must renew every 5 years, every year, every whatever, because the entity is dysfunctional. It just could not cope. I don't know where your the gentleman is. Who is he gone? The rest of your team left now. I presume so. Anyway, he usually just leaves halfway through the day. So, I really don't think we can pass legislation we know is going to fall flat. I agree, you should have to re-register, but as there's such chaos in terms of fees and what have you, I think it would have to be left to be implemented once this entity finally gets off the ground.
Honourable Lowell?
Now, the principal question, Chairperson. I have a company that's running. What is a reason for me to renew? That's a principal question. I think that's what we are asking on the renewal of registration. Why do you want me to renew? What for? Why do you want to get from me? And then what? And then and thereafter, how long are you giving me to renew? How long will I know that I've passed or not? I've accepted or not. If I've not accepted, do I have a chance of lodge my application again? What will happen? I think those are the things that we are asking here on the renewal. We are not just talking about a person who is just want to renew, but a company wants to renew who's got 1,000 security members and you want to renew. What are you saying to him or her?
Honourable Mulubatsi.
My question is, thank you, Chair. Will there be a moratorium on this renewal or what?
Because it's in the Act already, that's the point. Ms. Kulabarnat.
I think we must always remind ourselves that this must tie into the Firearms Act. So already renewals are needed for firearm licenses. There is a certain control from that side of things. And that legislation has to meld in with this one. So they're already under the obligation to get their firearms, any firearms, relicensed, and that's tracked in that manner. So those controls are already in place. Oh, well, yeah. Okay, fine.
Remember those,
they couldn't give us figures. Since I've been
headed that lot, I don't know where they are. No. You remember CIRA couldn't give us figures last week. So it's not that simple. Mr. Stuber, and then I want them to respond to it, please.
Chair, as far as we went through this, there's no other place in this legislation where it talks of the renewal of a registration. I think, and if I'm wrong there, just tell me I'm wrong. And I still think we must look at what was meant by a periodic application. And that is all that we need to know. And if there's not going to be a periodic application, and there's no use for a periodic application, why do we have to keep up with it?
Okay, and then the secretary.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to allude to the practical challenges which are associated with the non-renewal of registration. Currently what is happening is the companies would register with the authority and be issued with a certificate. And there comes a time when they no longer pay for their annual fees. When we then have to we have to withdraw the registration or suspend the registration, you find that you no longer find the company where it originally was supposed to be. They no longer comply with the infrastructure requirements. In other words, they're no longer running from an office, they're now running from a boot of a car and so on. So the renewal of registration would then assist in having those registrations lapsing so that they can then come and say, we are now still in compliance with the Act, we are still in compliance with the regulations, and we're still paying for our features.
No, my first question is, when did you do inspections not to find that out? Secretary.
Yeah, I think that the initial regulations, just to answer the question of periodic that were drafted, were 5 years. Now, the rationale behind those regulations back then was that the cornerstone internationally of dealing with the private security industry is through registration and training. Those are the two most fundamental aspects of your regulation of this industry, is that you deal with those. And what I think has come out internationally is that where you register for life and things happen in between then, like you get a criminal offence, and we've had examples of that. So if you look at a company that recently did voluntary vetting, they found that some of their guards who had been registered without criminal records had subsequently got criminal records. So it's just another check and balance. And if you look at your car license, if you look at any serious licensing process in countries, it provides for a renewal process, because that's one of your controls and checks and balances. It obviously doesn't negate your need to do compliance inspections, etc. But the initial regulations were for 5 years. But the reason why it was worded like this in the bill was that those regulations would come into effect when the authority had the capacity to actually implement them, rather than to put it in the Act as 5 years and then find that the authority couldn't implement it.
Honourable Stubber?
Chair, I can see if currently your license or your applications, you won't be terminated after 5 years. You can carry on with your business. That's how I got it. But I can see there might be a renewal for registration and a periodical application. If you take, for instance, I am going to start up a security business now. You grant me a periodical application license, or whatever you call it, for a period of 6 months. In after the 6 months, I must put proof that all the security guards has been working for me, or that I employ, that they went through their training and they're sufficient. They've got all the qualifications that need be, and then there might be a permanent license or whatever, but it's not in the Act. And if we then need this periodic application, then we must say it in the Act that is what we're going to do. But in terms of there's nothing that binds us to this.
That is exactly why I asked the question in the first instance. Why is it written the way it's written? If we want renewals, and I think what we need to do in order to move forward is first of all bring us the relevant regulations so that we can see it for ourselves. And I don't think the issue is here to make it a cumbersome exercise. You're not expecting them to jump through hoops and things like they did the first time with registration. It can be checking, it can be whatever the case may be, simplifying the matter as far as possible. But there is value in relicensing, or whatever you call it, what is it called, renewal of registrations. There is value in it. But we must put that value in such a way that the value is not overshadowed by the cumbersomeness and the cost of the renewal. So bring us the relevant section on the regulations on this issue. I'm also worried that 4 years ago, and since 4 years, we haven't made one single move in this direction. And this bill is how old? 2002. 2001. It's a 12-year-old bill. Act. 12-year-old act. And in 12 years, you've never got it up and running to do exactly that part of it. Also, what does a periodical application mean? You see, that's the things... But don't answer me now. Come back with the regulation so that we can ourselves have a look at it. Because clearly there is difference of opinions even amongst yourselves on this issue. And I would say also, you yourself, go through the regulations and come back with a firm proposal on what it should be. But if we are going to put it here, I agree with the Honourable Steward. Then we've got to be specific about what it is that we are asking. Because otherwise, the way it's drafted here now is exactly why CIRA is not moving on it. Because it's also not putting an obligation on them. It's also not putting an obligation on them. So it cuts both ways. Okay, can we move on?
Thank you, Chair. On page 4523, requirements for registration. Any natural person applying for registration in terms of section 21(1) may be registered as a security service provider if the applicant is a fit and proper person to render a security service. And, Chair, then we have changed D, was not found guilty of an offence specified in the schedule. We have deleted the last part. There was a long discussion on that. The effect of that would be, Chair, that if a person was found guilty of an offence in the schedule, he will be disqualified from being registered. Chair, if I can continue.
Anybody want to write anything on this one? Happy? Continue, please.
On page 46, Chair, subsection 4.
Sorry, there's a question from Honourable Malabatsi and then Honourable Stewart.
On the requirements for registration, C, relevant training requirements, which is what?
That's in the regulations, if I'm not mistaken.
They're prescribed in the regulations, Chair.
And in and Facito as well. So, but can I ask that on this issue also, just bring us that relevant regulation as well, that we can just see what it says. What is this training that we speak about? Because you're now expecting of us to say that this is fine the way it is, but we don't know what the regulation says. And we might not be happy with what the regulations say. So let us have a look at that.
Chair, maybe if we can get a set of the regulations, it will be also nice. But just before we go to four, there's something that to me that doesn't sound right. And I would just like to, if we look at two on page 46, there, right in the middle, there's three, the authority, just before there's a two, and then there's an A, and then there's in brackets a one. And a security business applying for registration as a security service provider in terms of section 21 may be so registered only if, and then that one complies with the requirement and submission and is not an unrehabilitated insolvent, and such security business meets the prescribed requirements in respect of the infrastructure and the capacity necessary to render a security service. Now, what is meant with infrastructure? Vehicles are supposed to be infrastructure, according to me, if you're in the security business. Now, must I have a car or can I have a pickup? Must I have an office in a certain part of town or can I work from my home? And the same with the capacity. What do we mean with capacity? I'm a small business, it's me and my wife or me and a partner compared to the bigger firms. How are we going to regulate that? How do you determine that if it is not prescribed in the Act? Otherwise, if it's in the regulations, then we have to see it. Thank you.
Yeah, I think it's something that you need to apply your mind to. This Act gives no indication to us on the type of security businesses that can register, guarding whatever, banking services, CIT, it gives us no indication. And maybe it should be in the Act to say you can register for the following following businesses. Then we can go into the detail in the regulations what the different requirements are. You can then even have different renew requirements depending on the kind of business that you are referring to. But we basically legislating now, while the sub-legislation, the regulations, has got more detail than what we are aware of in here. And that's my problem. I mean, the requirements of registration, that's fine. Is it the same requirement for every type of security business? That the regulations differentiate between different types of security? I would presume it does. If it's a guarding facility, a statutory guarding facility, why would it need vehicles? Why would it need vehicles, for instance? You understand what we're saying? So we need to get a clarity around this issue. Because this is the crux of the matter. I'm coming to you, Mr. Lefetu. So can you look at that? Maybe if you've got the regulations here, if somebody can speak to it, but we would like to see it. Mr. Lefetu.
Thanks, Chair. A natural person will apply for registration of this company, but if this natural person is no more, spouse has died, what happens? Thanks, Chair.
They would no longer be registered. They would. I mean, somebody else couldn't use their registration because the registration is specific to a natural person.
No, it can't be because the company does not cease to exist.
I think I can understand if I apply for the license. And I've got the license, and we're in a company, and I passed away. But the company doesn't die with me, it carries on. So there must then, if that's the case, that it must cease to exist, there must be something in the Act to say, if the license holder or whoever passed away, they must resubmit. It should be here, otherwise they can carry on forever.
It's clear for me that the section is not complete. And in order to save time, I think what we need to do is you go and have a look at the regulations, you come with a redraft on the section. That doesn't need to be for tomorrow already, but at least by Tuesday when we sit after tomorrow. So that we have this. I want us to continue with the bill, the rest of the bill. Because up to now we've actually made some good progress. I mean, this is really the first problem area that we're establishing, and I think this is the crux of the bill. And if we spend a bit more time on here, that's fine, because this is the make or break. So there's a bit of homework, I think, for you to go and have a look at. Members must also apply their minds in terms of what it is. But when we come back on this section, we want to know, Mr. Chokri, what type of security businesses can people register for? What are the differences? You're going to put it to us in a document, one or two pages. What type of businesses? What is the minimum criteria for each of these businesses? So that we can see and have an understanding of that as well. Otherwise, we're not going to be able to apply our own minds on how to separate this issue. Because it's becoming, for me, it's developing clearly that where we say registration of requirements, there will be general registration requirements, and then there might be specific registration requirements depending on the type of business that you are registering, the type of security service that you are going to provide. Ms. Kulabana?
I just want some law advice here. When you draft, as I have experienced, you tend to want not to detail specifics in that you may miss one out and then you've got a problem. Is there a possibility? Well, I understand the need to have perhaps specific categories or whatever. What if you leave one out and then there's a problem and you could do amendments? What is the norm in drafting? Is there a way to do it that could cover this but not perhaps paint ourselves into a corner?
You can respond to that.
Chair, I don't think there are really specific rules on that. It's a matter of, I want to say, common sense in terms of how detailed must the regulation in the Act be. And I think it's taking into account rights, etc. In a regulation, the regulation must, or the empowerment for the regulation must specify exactly how wide is that power, etc., etc. So there's not really a set of rules that you can lay down and say it's really looking at the circumstances of each act and the requirements, etc. I think, Chair, it might be that when this Act was drafted, that although we had the Security Officers Board legislation before that, that some of these issues might not have been as clear as it is now. And there might be some things that we want to regulate in the Act now whereas it was regulated by regulation. So I think it's free to the legislator to decide which issues must be taken up in the Act itself.
Yeah, and yeah, we're not going to go into the nitty-gritty detail, but surely we've got the ability and the common sense to say, for instance, if you are providing an armed guard response or escort, this is the following minimum requirements. The detail of it can be in the regulations, but it also empowers the authority if it is in the Act. But we're not discussing that now. They've got homework to do, but they've got to come back with a redraft on the section. It's clear this is one of the sections, and I tend to agree with you, Commissioner Jacobs, this is one of the sections that reflects on where we were at that time in the history of the country when we drafted this bill, because it was moving from a self-regulating authority to a regulating authority, and there were obviously some serious differences of opinion, etc. So things have developed as well. I mean, the people on the Defence Committee and Mr. Stuber will also know from State Security's point of view that, for instance, when we drafted this bill, you would remember as well, assistance in foreign countries, that wasn't an issue. 2 or 3 years later, it became an issue, and then we drafted the mercenary bill. But it's still not covered here, where there's actually a problem. So, you know, those are the things, as the world develops, that we need to take in consideration, I think. Okay, can we continue? So let's leave that. Did you respond to Ms. Mulabatsi's question on 4?
I don't think we haven't dealt with 4 yet, Chief.
Can you just put it? Okay, I'm still coming there. Okay, so let's go there quickly.
Chair, 4, the authority may refuse the registration of any person who, at the time of submission or consideration of the application, is under state investigation in respect of an offence specified in the schedule or who is being criminally prosecuted in respect of such an offence. And then, in line with the previous deletion, we've also deleted there, or was convicted of an offence specified in the schedule more than 10 years immediately before the submission of the application for registration to the authority. So it's just a consequential amendment to the other one, also referring to the 10 years. In other words, if a person has an offence in that schedule, the application must be refused.
Are you satisfied? Okay.
Chair, in sub 5, it was just the deletion of the Directorate of Special Operations, which is history. That's all in that section, Chair.
There must be some changes there, because during this year the SSA came into being. There's no intelligence agency, national intelligence agency. I don't know what the service is. And the South African Secret Service is out, the South African National Defence Force is there, and Correctional Service. But
this is the police, it's defined in the definitions, but no. I agree with you, the other wordings need to change.
So
as well.
Secret Service and National Intelligence must change to South African State SSA.
State Security Agency.
Agency, yeah.
And while the DSO is no longer there, we now have the Hawks there. Do we don't want to include them, or would you feel they're covered under the Police Act?
Chair, I think they are covered. I don't think it's necessary. There's elsewhere in the Act where there's also reference to National Intelligence Agency. We will align that as well.
Okay. Can you continue, please?
Thank you, Chair. On page 47, Register of Security Service Providers 24, there's no amendment proposed in that regard. 25, Registration and Identification Certificates, also no amendment there. Then 26, suspension, withdrawal and lapsing of registration. The authority may suspend the registration of security service provider if A, there is a prima facie case of improper conduct in terms of this Act, or 2, the commission of an offence referred to in the schedule, B, the security service provider fails to comply with the obligation to pay the levy in terms of Section 4 of the Levies Act, or C, a security service provider fails to comply with any provision of this Act. 2, the authority may suspend the registration of a security business if any of the grounds contemplated in subsection 1 pertain to a and presently reached natural person. We propose to delete natural person to say to pertain to a person referred to in section 22.
Can we just stop there quickly? There's issues around 26. Can we just talk about them quickly, members? The first one was the authority may suspend. Why the may and not the must? That's the first one. I see Honourable Stuber, I see Honourable Colobon.
Chair, yes. Yesterday we were talking about the may and the must, but you know, afterwards I read through this and particular with C, isn't it too harsh to say a security service provider fails to comply with any provision in this Act? In other words, there might be a small issue, and then if we say must, then they must scrap him from the register instead of the might.
No, I just want to remind you that we actually differentiated. We said must for A, 1, 2, and B, and may for C. Honourable Kula Bonan?
Yeah, there may be some difficulty here because there's no definition of what constitutes a prima facie case. So I think that needs to be defined, nor is there any provision that notice must be given to the security service provider that there is a prima facie case against them, because of course if the suspension took place without them being able to respond, then you could end up the absent people behind you could end up with a problem. I think that needs to be clarified. Sections out of the Firearms Control Act may be useful here. Sections 55 and 56. Detail a procedure that may be useful in this regard. Thank you. Do we have no one left from
C? Where's Mr. Choki? Hey, Mr. Stewart,
Chair, just to this prima facie case, for my own clarification, is that a prima facie case which the serum may have against a company? It's not any other prima facie case. Only if they have one. But then it's fine.
Can you just respond to those issues that was raised?
Chair, I am in agreement with the proposal that we change the first may to a must. And then in respect of C, I'm also in agreement that we must make that a may because it might have unintended consequences.
We change 1 26.1, the authority must suspend the registration of the security service provider if there is a prima facie case of improper conduct in terms of this act, or two, the commission of an offence referred to in the schedule, b, the security service provider fails to comply with the obligation to pay the levy in terms of section 4 of the Levies Act, and then all may suspend the security service provider who fails to comply with any provisions of this act. Yeah, that's the other thing that we wanted to know as well, the time frame.
The time frame for the payment of levies after a month, 2 months, 3 months, 6 months. We can't just say after the accounts went out, I'm in default now, they're gonna scrap my registration.
Yeah. You understand what we're coming at? Where we're going? With this, we say that B needs to have a provision. I think it's not an administrative justice provision. There's got to be a period for where the company gets informed. You have not paid. If you do not pay within 3 months, we will deregister you. And you most probably will have to inform them again before that 3 months, or when the 3 months arrive, say, if you're not paying within 7 days, we will deregister you. But the administrative justice part of it needs to come in here as well. I'm using administrative justice. I don't know what the right, but I think you understand what I'm saying.
Chair, I think we're in agreement with that as well, Chair, for a process like in the Farms Control Act. And we can build that in the subsection 5 on the next page. There is provision relating to the lapsing, where there is a specific 3 months period which is laid down there. So I think to do it in this regard as well, to have a process before you make a decision, that will be fine.
So that one, let's move on then from the. He's set now in terms of the Firearms Act, but let him repeat it again.
Yeah, Chair, we will definitely look at the process that will go before the decision to suspend. In other words, like the Chairperson has said, the administrative justice process preceding the decision. Thank you, Chair. Just a small amendment in subsection 4. The authority may, subject to section 5.3, withdraw the registration of a security service provider by written notice served on the security service provider if the security service provider has furnished to the authority information in or in connection. We have just deleted in or in connection, so it just reads to the authority information in connection with the application for registration, which is false.
Again, why are we allowing here may? Because if the pay bribe is big enough, it's never going to be a must. I'm just asking, if it's got to be may, you tell me it's got to be may, but I'm concerned about the authority, because you look at how many companies have actually deregistered, it's insignificant. The authority must, subject to section 5.3, withdraw the registration of the security service provider by written notice served on the security service provider if. And that's also going to go through the administrative justice process. It's not going to be that you just do it unilaterally. You're going to say to him, this and this is wrong, can you correct it? If not. But it's false information. If you give false information in your application for a firearm, that's reason enough not to give you a firearm.
I think personally that it has been quite a drafting style over a long period of time, and I think we are looking at a different view to that. I think in this regard it can also be a must. I don't see any problem with that.
And bringing the administrative justice again in this part of it, if necessary. If you feel it's covered, that's fine. I'm just alerting that we must make sure that it is there. Can we move on, members? Page 49.
Thank you, Chair. Subsection 5, subject to the provisions of the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act 2000, Act No. 2 of 2000, the registration of a security service provider lapses if A, it is not renewed as contemplated in Section 22, or B, the amount payable for levies in terms of Section 2 of the Levies Act is not paid to the authority within 3 months of the date of suspension of the registration of the security service provider concerned, unless the authority determines otherwise. 5A, if the registration of a security service provider has lapsed in terms of section 5, the authority must publish a notice in the Gazette indicating A, the name of the security service provider, B, the period after which the registration has lapsed, C, the reason for the lapsing of registration, and D, the effect of the lapsing of the registration. And Chair, then of course the issue about the renewal comes in here again.
Acted that way, because now again we're referring to renewals that's never been applied. Actually a joke, quite frankly. It's actually disgusting, to be quite honest. And then we blame if we're unhappy. We've got to sort this issue about renewals out. We've got to sort it out. If it's got to be there, it's got to be clear. Also in terms of CIRA's responsibility, so that it can't be this weak, blurry animal, you do it when you feel like it. If it's not got to be there, it's not got to be there. But we've got to sort it out. So we will deal with that part of it. I'll mark it here. We will deal with it when you come back on Section 22 around the renewals as well. Secretary.
I just wanted to give a concrete example of how important renewals are. 4 years ago, there was a voluntary vetting of only certain private security companies. And it was really done, those companies that wanted to vet did it, and those that didn't, we couldn't force them to vet. They vetted 123,000 guards in that process, and they found that 20% of them had criminal convictions post-registration. But we couldn't force it on all companies because it was a purely voluntary process that companies went through. So if you re-register, you are going to deal with that issue.
How many of the 20% were former SAPS members?
Okay.
Honourable Stewart?
But just to go back to AID. It is not renewed as contemplated in Section 22, or 22 is we still with the periodic application.
That's
the problem.
Yeah, that's why that out. We will not even discuss it now. They've got to come back with clarity on this issue. And I must say, after 11 months that you had to work on this, I would have thought you would have sorted it out already. Continue, please.
The Chair, on page 50, subsection 9, the authority must, and Chair, in line with our previous discussions, I would propose that we say the authority must, through the Council, report any suspension or withdrawal of registration made in terms of subsection 7, and any upliftment or suspension of registration made in terms of subsection 8 to the Minister within 30 days of the suspension, withdrawal or upliftment. And 10, the authority must include any report referred to in subsection 9 in its annual report.
I think we're in agreement with that. It addresses our concern of the double lines of reporting. Continue.
Chair, section 27 on page 50 was no proposal regarding any amendment on that.
Can I just ask, Ms. Kulabana, 27.1a, interdicting or interdict? Sorry, I'm just quickly going through it. I know we didn't have issues, but I just want to check. You've also taken on board the whole issue that we said you've got to look at the question that the Honourable Legato has also asked in terms of, and you most probably will find it within the Companies Act. You most probably will find it within the Companies Act if somebody, the original applicant, passes on that, what happens then? There might be guidance in that Act. Okay, Chapter 4, Code of Conduct.
Chair, page 52, section 28.2. The code of conduct is legally binding on all security service providers, and what we propose to take out, Chair, is irrespective of whether they are registered with the authority or not, and to the extent provided for in this Act, on every person using his or her own employees to protect or safeguard merely his or her own property or interests, or persons or property on his or her premises or under his or her command. Chair, we thought it's a bit of a contradiction as well to say that there's a code of conduct, and whether you're registered, whether you're legal or illegal, you must comply with the code of conduct. I think it's sort of giving some type of recognition as well to the illegal activities.
I think we agree with you on that one. You can't have a code of conduct for something that's illegal. The Act says you must register, bottom line. Happy? Okay, continue please.
Chair on page.
Can I just ask this question of his or her own property or other interests or business property? That's now, argument's sake, a farmer and some of his staff on the farm is also looking after whatever, guarding the crop when they take it off the land or whatever. I mean, I just want to understand what we're talking about.
Chair, this is an in-house security type of situation, and there were appeal court cases on it where it was actually, I think, confirmed what is in the Act, the Bertie van Sail case, if you remember.
You're referring to the De Beers company having an in-house security, is that, for instance, what you're referring to? Anglo having at its mines its in-house security. Okay. So it's what it basically does is also it makes it also, you know, doesn't go that far, but the security guards that have now been employed by SAPS. How does it affect them?
I think there is the exclusion regarding section 199 that we have referred to earlier today. I don't think it's applicable.
It's a pity, Mr. Choke. I would suggest you go to Bishop Lopes and you speak to the security guys there that are guarding Bishop Lopes College. They've been wearing the same uniform, one set of uniform, since November. One set of uniform. Shoes, pants, tops. They complained to me when we were there last week. So it needs to be corrected. Specifically by SAPS. Okay, continue.
Thank you, Chair. On page 53, there were no proposals there. Also not on page 54. The next amendment is on page 55 with section 32. An appeal committee contemplated in subsection 1 is appointed by the minister, and we propose that we delete for every appeal, and I think this has already been approved by the committee previously, Chair. The problem is that with each and every appeal, the minister must now appoint an appeals authority, whereas it can be done for a period of time. A person with no less than 5 years' experience as an attorney, advocate or magistrate who is the presiding officer and may also include the two other persons, if considered appropriate by the minister. I think just linguistically it looked strange with the it is. And 2A, A in brackets, an appeal committee is appointed to function on a part-time basis for a period not exceeding 3 years on such terms and conditions as may be determined by the minister, and be a member of the appeal committee may resign by notice in writing to the minister.
Ask Secretary, should we not combine the exemption and the appeal committee? Because we now establish an exemption committee and now we establish an appeal committee. And I'm worried because I know the challenges of getting people to serve on these bodies.
If you look at the number of appeals that we get versus the number of exemptions, you're talking about officials that have other duties that are going to consider the exemptions, and they're there because of their expertise in home affairs. With the appeals, we're getting a huge amount of appeals because they're appealing a sanction that CIRA has meted out, and they're now appealing that sanction. So almost on a weekly or bi-weekly basis, the minister's having to appoint a new appeals committee. So I don't think the exemption committee could do this appeals work, but certainly the fact that it's not a full, that it's now a permanent structure is going to save costs. Also, the cost must be borne by CIRA. At the moment, SACS is not happy with bearing the costs for CIRA's appeals. So in terms of this legislation, if this committee is appointed, the cost should come from CIRA as opposed to SACS, because that's been an ongoing debate.
Are you saying that in the legislation? No. So how do you think you're going to convince them to pay for it?
Chair, sorry if I can come in there. We actually obtained a formal legal opinion from the State Law Advisor saying that in terms of even the Act as it is now, the obligation is actually that of CIRA. We've made a special arrangement to pay because it's our minister appointing the appeals authority. The work must go on. So we have been paying this, but we also made it clear that once the Act is sorted out, but we can...
It is there on page 56.
We have actually put some... It was one of the proposals of SAPSJ.
It's there on page 56. I see that. Yeah, just access the interest account. It's not a problem. Ms. Kulabarnak?
Just to point out, anyone raised it, at number two, where you want to remove up at the top there, for every appeal and, you need to leave the and in there. Because it doesn't, an appeal committee contemplated in subsection is appointed by the minister for every appeal and consists of. So just leave the and in.
That's correct. We picked up on it. Yeah. Please. Okay, and what else? Honourable Mlabachi, you happy? Honourable Sevilla, you happy? Honourable Tilly? Just checking everybody. Okay, Honourable Mlova, are you happy?
No. I'm trying to find out what makes to come to 3 years. What is 3 years? Why is 3 years? I'm just asking. I just want to understand.
I think if I remember correctly, we actually came up with a suggestion of 3 years, and it's similar to the Firearms Appeal Board. The Firearms Appeal Board is also on a 3 year period. Yeah. And many of these people don't want to serve longer than that. It's not financially profitable for them in any case. The amount of money they get for serving on there is not huge. Okay. Are we happy with the 3 years? Can I ask you, just go through this for us, because I want to make sure that we cover here the issues that we've raised earlier in terms of the exemption board as well, removal, things like that, filling of vacancies on that board. So just go through it, if you don't mind, Commissioner Jacobs. Start with 2A. Just read it through for us from 2A so that we can just get a concept of it.
2A, an appeal committee is appointed to function on a part-time basis for a period not exceeding 3 years on such terms and conditions as determined by the minister, and be a member of the appeal committee may resign by notice in writing to the minister.
Continue with it, please.
Every person serving as a member of an appeal committee must be independent from the authority and may have no personal interest in the private security industry or in the affairs of an appellant. 4, the procedure in connection with the lodging and prosecution of an appeal in terms of this section must be prescribed. 5, the amounts payable by an appellant to the authority in respect of the reproduction of records and related matters in the lodging and prosecution of an appeal must be prescribed. 6, the appeal committee hearing an appeal in terms of this section may confirm, set aside or vary the decision or substitute for such decision any other decision which in the opinion of the appeal committee ought to have been taken, and direct the authority to do everything necessary to give effect to the decision of the appeal committee. And 7, a member of the appeal committee may be paid such remuneration and allowance as the minister may from time to time determine with the concurrence of the Minister of Finance. And 8, all costs related to the appeals procedure must be borne by the authority.
Can I quickly ask you 4 and 5? If you feel it's covered adequately and that I'm not seeing it, then I'm happy with it. But the procedure in connection with lodging and prosecution of an appeal in terms of section must be prescribed by the minister through regulations. I would be more comfortable if we're explicit about it. And for me, it's exactly because of 5. That we don't have a situation where costings and things are decided unilaterally and in the end we've got to defend something in court that's costing money and is hampering the operation. So 5 as well, the amounts payable by an appellant to the authority in respect of the reproduction of records in related manners in the lodging and prosecution of an appeal must be prescribed by the minister through regulations. Are we happy with that, members?
I think when this act was drafted, also things like PAYA and all that wasn't so there. Actually now, in terms of those legislation, there are prescripts in terms of costs of documentation, etc., that we can maybe just look at.
Yeah, but the point is, we don't want a situation like the 900% levy increase. So that's why I say let it be prescribed by the minister through regulations.
In other words, it should be standardized.
Yeah.
Should be standardized.
Yeah.
So that everybody will understand it.
Yeah. Okay, members, are we happy in terms of this with the appeal board? Appeal committee? It seems like it. Continue then, chapter 5, monitoring and investigation.
Thank you, Chair. On page 56, appointment of inspectors, section 31. No amendment proposed. And then on page 57, Code of Conduct for Inspectors, it's proposed that subsection 4 be inserted. The authority must include any penalties imposed under subsection 3 in the annual report.
Honourable Stuber, Honourable Kulabana, Honourable Mulabatsi, in that order.
Chair. The if there's a penalty to an inspector by breaching the code of conduct, in 4, the authority must include any penalties imposed under subsection 3. Can't we say the authority must include information so that the information be otherwise In the annual report or something, like in the SEPS annual report, let people know who transgressed.
Yeah, I would support that. I don't know how other members feel, because, you know, we don't want to see a situation where the person has received a bribe and then Ciro give him a penalty, but we don't know about it. And should you really give a penalty to an inspector that's received a bribe, shouldn't that inspector be fired? You know, those are the kinds of things you want to see through that information. No, but wait a bit now, you're confusing me. This is not for... Yeah, that is code of conduct for inspectors.
Yeah.
Okay. How many inspectors do you have, Mr. Choki? 64.
In that region, Madam Chairperson, I don't have the exact number with me at the moment.
64 more or less. I think it's 64. Can you just explain to us what clause 531(5) is saying? The council or the director, if he or she has been authorised generally or specifically by the council, may, if it's considered necessary, in the circumstances to acquire special or to augment the capacity of authority, temporarily appoint any person who is not in a full-time employment of authority as an inspector for a particular inspection or to assist an inspector with a particular inspection. And breathe. Is it not possible to simplify it? I understand what you're saying there, but Mr. Soman, Is it your drafting in 2001? But I'm pretty sure you've developed since then. I understand what it is that you're saying here, where you don't have the special expertise for a specific inspection. Secretary, we don't have the specific expertise for a specific inspection. Let's say firearm inspection. And you might not have somebody that's qualified enough. You want to get somebody in to do that that specific inspection for you. But surely it can be put more clearer. And also this whole issue again of the authority versus the council here. Why must the council give permission for this kind of inspection? I can understand that they must know about the appointment of that person. Sorry, I can't hear you, Honourable.
I was asking why do you employ a person who doesn't qualify as an inspector?
I can't hear you.
What? No. If I read it wrongly, madam. If it is considered necessary in the governance to acquire special expertise or to augment the capacity of the authority temporarily, what does that mean?
Yeah, I would like the Honourable Stubborn, then I'll come to you.
Chair, the council or the director, the council, wasn't that previous when the chairperson of the council was the CEO, permanent, and the CEO, and if that changed, I think that should also change the council, that it should, I don't know what the director, is that the director of finance, the director of what, or must that be the CEO of the company, or I think that whole five must change.
Can you look at five, please? We'll mark it for redraft. Mr. Soman is now going to redraft it in 2013 language. This is 2001 language. It may be so, but we've also developed since then. Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, the next one is on page 58, section 34.
Sorry, can we just go back to the previous one? Mr. Chauke, how often have you appointed such a person?
We haven't appointed any such services. However, we have offered the state security to appoint some of their officials to do inspections in companies that were in possession of, these monitoring devices. That they, but they haven't made any formal request to such. So, virtually, it has never been used as far as I'm aware.
I think they haven't made any formal request because they don't need to go through you to do that. That's the problem. They don't have to do that, Mr. Stewart.
Chair, what monitor devices are we talking about? I would love to know that.
Which company?
I'm not sure if I'm getting the question.
No, it's asking what monitoring device, because monitoring devices are supposed to be illegal.
Can I just clarify? You were saying, Mr. Chauke, that you invited the SSA people to have people there with you to monitor certain of these private companies that use monitor devices. Now, I'm only asking, what type of monitor device are you referring to? Is that I would like to know, because there's legislation on that. I just want to hear, because are they legislate, are they act, are they doing what they do in terms of the legislation, the current legislation?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know what type of monitoring devices we're talking about here. What I was referring to is that in cases where the state security would want to look at security service providers who would be in possession of such devices that would maybe outlawed, then they would need to be given appointed in terms of this section.
Way that the state security or the police will have to get an inspector's certificate in order to do what is needed. No way. But even that is not the issue. The issue is they've got their own powers to do exactly that. If they believe an act has been broken by a security service provider, with or without you, they can act on that. They don't have to go through you to get a certificate as an inspector. I mean, you know, let's say, for instance, the walks are investigating something like that. You're not telling us that they can't do it without the certificate from you appointing them as a part-time inspector. I'm coming back to your secretary.
Chair, I think we need to be specific. The state agencies have their own powers and this does not refer to them. This is referring to a situation where you may need a computer expert. Your inspector has gone out and they've seized certain files or they've seized the computer because they believe that there's something serious going on in this company. But files have been deleted and now you need a computer expert to come in and assist you with recreating those files. Or the inspector doesn't have serious forensic audit skills, and you need to bring in a forensic audit. So I think that even within the DPCI legislation, we make provision for the fact that a DPCI investigator might not have all the skills and that they can call in expertise. And I think this is the same provision. I think the wording needs to be made more simple, and we actually discussed that before we submitted the bill. But also that the council shouldn't make that decision, because you actually don't want the council involved in the investigation process. It should be the director.
But Secretary Still, do you really want that person to be appointed as an inspector? I think you guys need to go and relook this thing. Because also the fact that they've never utilized it. Now, I'm not saying the fact that they've never utilized this means that we shouldn't have it. It just indicates the level of inspections that we've been receiving. But re-look at it and be more specific about what it is that we are looking for. I don't understand this section. Honourable Mulabatsi.
To my mind now, Chair. Is these inspectors are all on the same level?
There are senior inspectors at national office which earns less than the salary in the secretary of the council chairperson and the secretary of the executive director, which is also something that's going to change with this act, I can tell you now, because there's no way that the public service and administration is going to fall for that one. But there are senior inspectors, if I remember correctly, two of them at national office, four.
There's quite a number of them, Madam Chair. It's not only two.
Yeah, but you had two specific. Who are they? The ones that you highlighted.
The Madam Chair, you're referring to investigators.
Are they the investigators, senior investigators?
No, they are senior inspectors. There are also senior investigators.
The senior investigators were earning less than the secretaries. I'm sorry. It makes it even worse. Members, I'm trying to find out whether there's tea or something, but I need a break. I don't know about you. That just stretch our legs also, because we've still got 2 hours to go. Can we stretch our legs for 10, 15 minutes? Please. Don't you want to take a break, Anton? You must walk.
I'm from outside. You must remember.
I need to have good delay now, yeah. I'm falling out of class, cut it. But if I sit down for too long, why do I sing up again? I just say I missed your call, and I'm returning your call. It's now 20 to 5. Please make it for some means to call me back. Thanks. Look, we are going to put you in. Finally, it's going to be Umuchiba. Lower the call. I'm not telling anything.
Well, just before we continue, Mr. Choki, what is the investigators doing? And where in the Act do we make provision for investigators?
Our current investigators, Madam Chair, they do two types of investigations. They do internal investigations, and they also do investigations that relates to the criminal offences. Basically, they are appointed more like inspectors in terms of the act. So they would investigate where there is criminality by the industry, as well as where there's corruption by the internal staff.
Your responsibility is to say we suspect criminal actions in this industry, in this company. Then you report it to SAPS.
That is basically what they're doing, Madam Chair.
But then what are they doing? Why are they earning a salary at all?
That is what they're doing is they would then contact the complainants. They do pick up affidavits. And they will then review the matters and compile an affidavit where they complain as the complainant on behalf of CIRA and lay criminal charges against those who have contravened the act. And the police would then proceed with the investigation.
We in the act will make provision for investigators.
Sure. Let's look at the section 34. I think there was somewhere else in section 34 where it made provision for matters to be investigated in respect of the...
See, my concern is that investigating, according to the Constitution, investigating responsibilities lies with SAPS. And that's what worries me about this. Commissioner Jacob?
I think specifically for that purpose, the Act provides presently that SAPS members have the same powers as inspectors of the of CIRA.
I'm not surprised because we appoint researchers, we appoint event managers, event officers. Oh, let's continue. It's clear from Secretary, I want to get Commissioner Jacobs. When we do the transitional arrangements, I want you to have a look at specifically the changes in responsibilities, etc., that we've put in place. Because I think we're heading into the same direction as we did with the Hawks and with IPED, in terms of people having to, at certain levels, have to reapply for their positions. Because the criteria for those positions are changing. The responsibilities are changing. So can you have a look at that? You don't have to respond to us tomorrow on it. I just want us to keep that in mind in terms of the transitional arrangements. I'm seriously worried. Okay, let's continue, please.
Thank you, Chair. On page 58, section 34, 1A, we say that in order to carry out an inspection of the affairs of a security service provider or another person contemplated in section 33, an inspector may at any reasonable time, A, without prior notice, and then we've just inserted subject to subsection 6, enter any premises. And Chair, if we would go to subsection 6 on page 62, it says that an inspection of private dwellings may only be carried out when authorized by a warrant issued by a competent court. It's to provide for that exception, Chair. Chair, then we have made just a small amendment on page 59, Roman 3. It reads, where or from where a security service is rendered, or the director has reason to believe that such a service is rendered. We have just inserted the two commas there. I think it makes it more clear. We considered taking out one of the wares, but I think it makes sense, but if the commas is, are in there.
I think it makes sense, members.
Okay, then the next amendment is on page 62, 3B. An inspector may use the powers in terms of this subsection only to serve the purposes of this act. And we have deleted or proposed to delete and matters incidental thereto. We think it actually conveys a much broader power than is intended. If the and matters incidental thereto is included, and it's also vague in that sense, Chair.
Can I just hear you on that one, sorry? Can I just hear you on that one? Inspector may use the powers in terms of the subsection only to serve the purpose of this act. I think it's correct. It's more tight. Happy? Happy. Continue.
Thanks, Chair. Subsection 6 we have already really dealt with now, Chair.
Yeah, I think the subsection 6 is important because entering of premises without a warrant is just not on. Okay, Chapter 6, General Provisions.
Thank you, Chair. Dealing with the regulations, Section 35. The Minister may make regulations to A, any matter which in terms of this Act is required or permitted to be prescribed, B, the registration by the authority of security service providers, and then we propose to include including the procedures in relation to the suspension, withdrawal and lapsing of registration. Then C, periodic applications for renewal of registration and the conditions upon which such applications are to be granted. I will mark this that we will specifically look at it in context with the rest. The obligatory undergoing of security training by security service providers. E, ensuring the quality of training as contemplated in Section 4K or any other law in respect of security service providers and prospective security service providers. It's proposed to insert EA guidelines in respect of insignia, emblem, title or symbol, whether on a uniform, vehicle or otherwise. Yes, Chief.
I'm asking members that they also align that with what we said previously in terms of the uniforms, vehicles, etc. The whole thing, okay?
If, Chair, the registration and identification certificates of security service providers, G then also links up with the insignia, the types of uniforms, insignia, emblem, title, symbol, distinctive badges or buttons which may not be supplied to, used or worn by a security service provider. And then, Chair, as the committee has indicated, we must also look at the transitional provisions in that regard.
And we just, can you just explain to us the difference between EA and G?
EA is really only guidelines in respect of the insignia, emblem, title or symbol. And G is the types of uniforms which may not be supplied.
It's not possible to combine these two. And the one...
Can you get that,
please, I think it just reads difficult. It seems like we're a repetition. I know it's not a repetition, but it seems like it is. If we can just combine those two. Honourable Kulabana?
Yeah, I was just thinking, I know that you had the idea that maybe we should have photographs of the uniforms, etc., but I think this is a really effective way of saying, detailing what you may not use. You may not use X, Y, Z. That's it, you know, because other than that, there's a thousand other ways they can create something to make their business look distinctive. So I think laying out what they absolutely may not use would be extremely effective. I like that one.
It doesn't take away from what we said previously. With registration, they still need to submit that so that you can make clear that you can determine that it is not the same. There is something else in this section that's what I wanted to say. Under regulations, it says the minister may make. We have now already specified certain issues where he must. And I think we must, in this section, just also look at the mays and the musts. And in my mind, EA and F can also be included in the musts. EA, F, and G can also be included in the must, taking on board the comment that the Honourable Quillebaugh not now made. So let's look at a differentiation between the musts and the mays, which means you will have to go back to some of the issues that we've raised already. Members, anything else on that? Continue, please.
Chair, because the regulations are important, shall I go through all the regulation parts or just the new insertions?
Let's just go through the new ones. I think what we're asking you is to go back and look at it, and that we can differentiate between the mays and the must, because there might be others that is in here that will become musts.
Chair, then LA on page 65 is inserted. The type of information which security service providers must furnish to the authority when rendering a security service outside the Republic. Chair, then I'll just mention M, the issuing possession and use of firearms and other weapons by security service providers. Chair, previously the committee, I think it was a previous committee, decided that firearms regulations need to be dealt with in terms of the Firearms Control Act. So I'm not sure whether the committee want to retain this provision in here or whether we will actually rely on the Firearms Control Act.
Now we're talking about two mishaps and trying to pick the less of the two evils. Let me understand it clearly. First of all, and I think that's where you've got to answer your own question. First of all, the security provider must apply to CIRA to provide the type of security service that would require a firearm. That's the first thing. So we can't take it away completely. I think that's how you need to look at it in terms of the wording. They've got to apply for that. Once they've applied and they've received it, they can then apply for the firearms through the normal Firearms Control Act. So what I'm saying is the security service provider can't go to SAPS and say, I want to have 50 firearms because I'm going to do the following guarding, which requires firearms, unless they've got the certificate already. Correct? That say they can provide that kind of service. They've been registered to provide that kind of service. So all I'm asking is, I don't think anywhere is this clear. So let us try and make that clear. That taking on board what you're saying, I agree with that part of it, and I think members also agree in terms of the Firearms Control Act, but also it does not take away the obligation on CIRA to issue the person or the business with a certificate that say they can provide armed guarding. Understand what I'm saying, Mr. Soman? Looks like I'm talking 2001 language. Members, do you agree with that? Okay, so let's continue, please.
Thank you, Chair. The insertion on page 65 of paragraph SA, minimum standards applicable to security service providers responsible for the safe transportation of cash or goods with a high value, including precious metals or jewelry. SB, minimum standards for the provision of security services at national key points, as referred to in Section 1 of the National Key Points Act 1980, Act Number 102 of 1980.
Can we get clarity? Is security, private security companies still providing security at national key points? They are?
Yes, okay. Chair, definitely.
Okay. Ms. Kulubana?
Yeah, that's safe transportation of goods with a high value. I mean, yeah, I think you have to be a little more specific about what that is. Minimum standards in relation to the transportation of cash being, are we looking at value? I mean, you know, what is a high value to you may not be a high value to anybody else. I think we have to be a little more specific in what we're referring to there.
I must remind members that we referred to it earlier in the Act, where it says if you transport for compensation, then you would fall under this. So if I'm transporting the Honourable Mulabatsi's millions rands worth of jewellery, and she pays me for it, I would fall under here. If she transports it on her own, she will not fall under here, even if it's the same monetary value.
Should it not then just specify minimum standards applicable to security service providers responsible for the transportation of cash, precious metals, or jewelry for compensation. And with that, then it doesn't matter how much it's worth. It can be one diamond ring or 1,000.
We only refer to
page.
No,
where are we referring to it previously now?
On page 13, Chair, the definition.
Yep. You see that it's defined, so I don't think it's defined, so it shouldn't be a problem.
It's part of security service.
LA, the one in the red. So it's defined. Okay. Are you satisfied with that? Ms. Kulabana, is that 65? Okay. Continue, please.
Chair, I can just mention it's actually an outcry of many years after. You remember there were security guards who were burnt out in the vehicle, etc. And that is all background to it.
So, national key points, we've also dealt with that part. Let's continue then.
Chair, on page 66, subsection 3, regulations made in terms of subsection 1 may, in respect of any contravention thereof or failure to comply therewith, prescribe as a penalty a fine or imprisonment for a period not exceeding 5 years. We've increased that from 24 months to 5 years. For the minister may, after consultation with the council, issue guidelines or policies in relation to the governance of the authority. And 5, any regulation made under this section must be tabled in Parliament for notification.
Can we change that may to a must? The minister must, after consultation of council, issue guidelines or policies in relation to the governance of the authority. And it is now more desperate than ever that we do it that way. Any regulation made under this section must be tabled in Parliament for notification. It's consideration. There's sections that we would like to see. I mean, there's no question about it, that we would like to see. Secretary?
We not make the must ones tabled in Parliament for consideration and the may for notification, because otherwise you'll be...
That's fine. Musts for consideration, mays for notification. Consideration means approval. And I know Minister is not against Parliament giving its input on these things. So, it's not as if he would have a problem with it. So let's continue then. You've got that, Commissioner Jacobs. It's just a small change then. Provision of information.
Thank you, Chair. On page 67, subsection 3, the authority must inform the registrar as defined in section 1 of the Firearms Control Act 2000, Act number 60 of 2000, at the time of any new registration, suspension, sale, transfer, liquidation, merger, lapsing or termination of the registration of ownership of a security service provider, or any other reason that would necessitate the licensing, relicensing, or disposal of firearms in the possession of such security service provider. And then for the registrar mentioned in subsection 3, that the firearms registrar must, at the written request of the director, submit a list of all firearms registered to a particular security service provider to the authority within 30 days of the request being made. Chair, the subparagraph or subsection 4 is actually related also to inspections, in order to arm the inspector with the firearm so that it can be checked. And I think, Chair, 3 is an attempt to really address some of the problems that we experience presently with security companies being in possession of firearms where the company has been transferred, etc., and the necessary paperwork has not been done.
You have not defined the registrar. You should define the registrar in the beginning of the Act. It's not defined. because when I first read it, I thought we were referring to the Register of Companies Act or something like that. So can we define that? Sorry, can I just, Honourable Kulabana, before I get to you, also in terms of Honourable Legeta's question, although it was not related to this specifically, we say at the time of any new registration, suspension, sale, transfer, liquidation, will that fall under the transfer? Somebody dying and then transferred to somebody else?
Chair, what we really tried to do here was to imagine what are all the factors that may lead to a re-registration of the firearms. So we've really, maybe it looks a bit wild that we've inserted all these things, but those are all the eventualities that we really could think of. But once the ownership changes, or there's a change that caused the change of the firearms license as well, then it must be registered so that it can be followed up that the firearms are legally possessed.
Is this not all covered under the firearms legislation already? I mean, you know, in order to obtain a firearm license in a security company, the company needs to be registered already. I mean, it's all pretty much covered under the firearm legislation. I'm just scared we're like repeating it all over when it's already out there.
I think it's got to do more about changes of status. So even if it's covered, it's CIRA's responsibility. This is what it determines. It's CIRA's responsibility to inform the Central Firearm Registrar about the changes of ownership, the lapsing of a company, etc., etc. So while the registrar's got a certain responsibility, the first responsibility lies with CIRA to inform the registrar. Otherwise, the registrar's not going to know it. So it's good that it's here. But you're still not answering my question, should we not make provision, for instance, death? I'm just asking, because now the Honourable Legeta's question can also mean you can have the situation that there's no provision to transfer it to somebody else, or it's not, the company basically ceased to exist. Small company, the owner died, had 30 guards.
Could we not use the term any other material changes, because it may be beyond death, something that we haven't anticipated, and that.
And then you make sure you understand. Commissioner Jacobs, you wanted to add to that?
No, Chair, I think I agree with the proposal from the Secretary. I just want to say I think this section will actually contribute a lot to enforcement, because I think one can say there must be inspections and this and that and the other thing, but these changes are changes that must be noted at the authority. And once SAPS is alerted thereto, there is a follow-up that must take place, and these are things that can be followed up and made sure they happened or they did not happen. So I really think it will assist a lot in the enforcement.
Can I hear you on the following? What about a further Section 5 under this that says the authority must report on these in its annual report so that we can follow what is happening? There's changes, but also is there a problem with the Central Firearm Register? They can then report, we have said this, this was the follow-up action, etc. Honourable Kulabana?
Yeah, I mean, my immediate reaction was to say yes, but I think initially we need to look at the number, ballpark figure of how many re-registrations, sales, transfers, liquidations, mergers, etc., etc., are you dealing with in a year? I mean, we may find that it's many, 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 in which case it can't be detailed.
We can talk about the detail of it. How many do you deal with in a year?
Thank you, Madam Chair. In terms of the suspensions, it's quite a lot that we're dealing with on a month, in fact, on a weekly basis. The sales are not reported to us. There's currently no requirement other than them reporting to us that the business is no longer in their ownership. So we don't keep those kind of statistics. We simply do the changes as the providers have reported to us that the ownership has not been transferred. So liquidations, we do deal with them. Measures are currently not
but
reported.
Focus, but you're answering on licenses for registration for companies with firearms. Focus first on that. How many of those do you deal with in terms of these things on a monthly basis?
Madam Chair, the licenses for firearms are submitted at the Central Firearm Register. We deal with the inquiries on a weekly basis, so there's quite a number of them. It's quite a lot.
So, okay, I'm going to explain again. We've just gone through the process. The process is before the person can apply for licenses, firearm licenses, they must have a certificate from CIRA to say they are registered to provide an armed security service. Correct?
Not correct, Madam Chair.
Not correct?
Not correct.
Well, then you, Commissioner Jacobs, are saying...
The applications for...
Sorry! Let us first finish speaking and then you start speaking. Commissioner Jacobs and you are then saying come two different things. Explain it from your point of view, please. Explain it from your point of view, from CIRA's point of view.
The applications for security service providers are general applications. In other words, the company would come and apply for to render security service. Currently, we do not issue licenses for them to only do guarding or to only do CIT or to only do any other electronic security or other type of security services.
We don't know how many firearms is in the security industry. I don't understand this because that has never been anybody's understanding of this issue. Secretary.
Two things. First of all, my understanding is in that section you've asked us to look at. We need to actually be able to provide Sarah with the basis to say that you have to list what services you're providing, because it will actually assist the Central Firearm Registry to know that this company is actually providing CIT services and they registered to provide those services and that's why they're applying for a license. But my understanding is that when a company applies for a license, their registration at the Central Firearm Registry is checked with Sarah, that they are in good standing. So it may not be that CIRA licenses firearms, but the CFR, General Jacobs is right, when somebody applies for a license with the CFR as a matter of procedure come to CIRA and check if that company is registered.
Secretary, that's not addressing our problem either. Because our problem now is somebody is registered with CIRA. Why are we worried about different kinds of services then? As long as you're registered with CIRA as a service provider, go and apply for a firearm. Even though you're not supposed to be giving an armed service. That is my concern. And that's why we have the situation that more and more private security officers are using personal firearms. Sorry, I don't understand this. It is... clear why when we asked for the audited figures it couldn't be given to us on this.
Chair, is it not to, the whole purpose is to regulate firearms that might land up somewhere and I think maybe this whole the how we how CIRA must deal with the firearms in the register now, they must report on it and maybe to put it in an annual report. There must be some sort of oversight and it must be able to help the police determine who is in possession. I think maybe we need to just sit maybe tomorrow sometime, just 50 minutes and just speak on this in
and I'll see how it can work out. Otherwise, I don't know.
I take your point on board. My concern is that this is not what the Firearms Act intended. You can't apply for a license at the firearm, for a firearm license, unless you're conducting business, unless you're a person who is a firearms dealer, you're a registered hunter, sportsman, etc. I think this whole process, and I agree with you, but I don't think we will have to do it. They need to go and do it. They need to go and sit and see how the system works. Because what should happen, surely you can't say the guy with 10 guards that got a security company registered with zero can now apply for 20 firearms. That's the implication we have. So where's the synergy? I don't see the synergy between CIRA's responsibility and the Central Firearms responsibility, and that's what you guys need to go and sit with. Because that's clear, and that's where the Honourable Kula Barnard is correct. That wasn't the intention of the Act here. It's not addressing the intention of the Firearms Control Act. And it's clear that you guys didn't talk to each other, that's why you're talking past each other. Ruling. On this issue, we're coming back tomorrow. I don't care until what time you sit under this, with this issue, because this is a very, very serious issue. We keep on saying there's more firearms in the private security industry than in the police, based on what? Thumbsuck. Because that's what we're saying now. Thumbsuck. This section needs to talk to the Firearms Control Act. It needs to complement the Firearms Control Act. There is a dual responsibility on both CIRA and the Central Firearm Register. CIRA to say this is what the person, the company is registered for, the type of services they must provide. Central Firearm Register to say this is the firearms that we've issued, licenses that we've issued to this company. Again, CIRA. This is the change of status in this company. Central Firearm Register, go and remove the firearms, whatever the case may be. That is what we need to see here. And then the added issue of 5, report in the annual report to the Portfolio Committee. Mr. Stuber.
Chair, but surely also, CIRA must complement in a way that If something happened, it was only said that they deal with people that insolvencies, am I right? But if a company ceases to exist, there's a deregistration. And I think it is vital that immediately, and not on a monthly basis or twice monthly, but immediately, if somebody is aware of a deregistration, that those firearms must be taken to possession and delivered to the police or somewhere. Otherwise, they might end up in the street. I think that is what we want to regulate. We don't want to regulate and say you may have firearms you are not allowed to, and you may have a firearm. I think we must see to it that firearms is not lying around.
That's the first part of it. The part is who are in the business that requires a firearm. That's first part. Second part is what is the change in status. That is CIRA's responsibility. SAFSA's responsibility, Registrar's responsibility then is to say to CIRA, this company we have issued with 50 firearm licenses. When you go and do inspections, check whether there are 50 firearms there. Such responsibility, if CIRA tells them there's a change in status, is then to take those firearms for disposal or whatever the case may be. That is how we get illegal firearms outside. It underlines the issue that have been made over and over again, that the biggest source of illegal firearms in this country is previously legal firearms. Redraft. section 6, this section. Can we move on? Security services rendered outside the public.
Thank you, Chair. Page 67, 36A. 1. Any person who, within the Republic, recruits, trains, hires out, sends or deploys any other person to provide a security service outside the Republic must A. provide to the Director on a quarterly basis such information as may be prescribed regarding such recruitment, training, hiring out, sending or deployment or nature of the security service within the prescribed time limits, and B. comply with the provisions of this Act. 2. A person referred to in subsection 1 may not engage in any activity or render any assistance that is prohibited in terms of the prohibition of mercenary activities and regulation of certain activities in country of armed conflict, Act 2006, or the regulation of Foreign Military Assistance Act 1998, Act 15 of 1998. 3. Any person who is employed by another person from outside the Republic, and B. is deployed from the Republic to perform armed guarding services outside the Republic, must at least 2 weeks before the deployment inform the authority of such deployment in the prescribed manner. 4. The information referred to in subsection 3 must be submitted by the authority to the service within 7 days of receipt of the notification. Chair, and I think you have made mention that this is an attempt to also regulate services outside, and which many times is suspect mercenary activities, etc., and to pick up that type of activity.
Honourable Stubbe.
Just to come again, that 36A1A, provide to the Director on a quarterly basis such information as may be prescribed. Now, is there something that is being described in the regulations, or we say may be described? So if it's not described, what then?
Yep.
Then this is it's not. There's no use having it there.
Is there something available currently, Mr. Choke?
There is nothing available currently, Madam Chair. This provision is a new provision altogether.
Again, Chair. You see, if you turn around, also there's in 3B. It also says authority of such deployment in the prescribed manner. If there is something that needs to be done, it must be somewhere. Otherwise, what is prescribed? We don't know what is prescribed. What is needed? If you have to fill in a report, what must be in the report? A. Which country are you? What? A, B, C, D. And if there is no such thing, then we must seriously have a look at it and see to it that it either in the somewhere parked in the regulations in order to comply with this.
If I remember correctly, there is something in the Mercenaries Act and that other one. But I agree with you. It must be. Otherwise, why do we have it? What are they going to do? To describe, so these, what we're saying is these becomes must again for the minister to regulate on. Honourable Dlova, then Honourable Kulabon.
Can you read two, Chairperson, on 62? I just want to understand what that may stand for.
A person referred to in subsection 1 may not engage in any activity or render any assistance that is prohibited in the prohibition of mercenary activities and regulation of certain activities in the country of Armed Conflict Act or the regulation of Foreign Military Assistance Act.
May not engage. May not.
Yeah, but this may is not like the must. This is a clear, they may not. Yeah, it's against the law. Ms. Kulabana?
Yeah, Chair, you've referred frequently today to the regulations. as if they exist. You know, the second-hand goods bill, it took 4 years before the regulations were drawn up, and only then did they start thinking of implementing it. Are these regulations already drawn up and good to go, and or are we, you know, you keep saying look in the regulations. Do they actually already exist?
There are some regulations, but obviously for the new provisions there won't be, and this is one of the new provisions.
I think that maybe it's also a wording issue. Firstly, it must, because we must make regulations on this. It's a serious issue internationally, so it shouldn't be maybe prescribed. It should be must be prescribed in regulations for the minister.
Secretary,
so
wait. Blame it on the fact that I'm tired, but don't tell me it's a wording issue. You guys have come here with that wording. It should have been must. Continue.
Chair, the other thing I want to raise, which is that we should be talking about state security, not the service, and I think that's an error from our side, because SAPS should not be dealing with foreign intelligence issues, it's state security. And when we start bringing the SAPS bill, we're going to be confining what crime intelligence does. So instead of service, we should replace that with state security.
Where are you now?
Where they have to report, where the authority reports.
Refer us to the section.
Page 68, section 4, the information referred to in subsection A must be submitted to by the authority to the service. I'm just saying that's an error from our side. It should be to state security, because that should not be dealing with foreign intelligence.
Mr. Bird, you agree with it? Mr. Stubbe, you agree with it? I think they're correct, because I don't think SAPS deals with external, well, they're not supposed to deal with external intelligence.
And Chair, if we can ask that when we meet, they must bring the regulations that exist with them so we can now start comparing. Because there's huge areas being covered by the regulations.
We have done that already. There are specific ones that they must extract from the regulations so that we don't have to go through all of them, so that we can see what the regulations say, and then there are the regulations in general that we want a copy of. I would also like to know what the status of these regulations are while you're bringing it to us. Mr. Stubber?
This again is very difficult. Any person, 3 on page 68, any person, A, who is employed by another person from outside the Republic, and is deployed from the Republic to perform armed guarding service outside the Republic, must at least 2 weeks before the deployment inform the authority of such deployment in the prescribed manner. In other words, I'm a security guard, I'm working for Company A. Somebody from outside comes and recruit me for a salary hike that nobody can believe. Now the onus is on me, who's been recruited, to go and say to Sira, listen, hey, I'm on my way, I'm going overseas, I'm going as a guard somewhere. How are you going to regulate that? It's very difficult to regulate such a thing. And to place the onus on the guy who's going to work overseas. The other thing might also be, I'm a student and I'm on a working holiday overseas, and I get employed as a armed guard in Timbuktu. How am I going to let Sira know that I am employed as an armed guard? It doesn't make sense to me.
Covered in the Mercenary Act as well. They are covered, if I'm not mistaken. You can help me on this, but I remember this very same debate many years back when this was passed. I also remember the example of the student getting employed while on a gap year.
It's again a matter of definitions, etc. Some countries talk about foreign military assistance. Some talk about defense or military services. Within a South African context, there is nothing like legal military services that can be that you can be trained for, etc., etc., except for the South African National Defense Force. But Chair, I think if I read 36A1, any person who within the Republic recruits, trains, hires out, sends or deploys another person. In other words, this obligation is on the person who sent someone. It's not on the person who will actually perform the service. The object with subsection 2 is really, the prohibition is already in subsection 2. Or let me put it in the foreign military legislation. But it is to prevent that the person argue that because I'm registered in terms of the CIRA Act, I can now go and do this and this outside. It's really to emphasize that the registration in terms of this act or the notification in terms of this act does not relieve you from the obligations and the crimes that can be committed in terms of the mercenary legislation.
Honorable Stewart.
Chair, I understand that first part. If you say 36A1, any person within the Republic, but 3 specific say any person who is employed by another person from outside the Republic, and that's where I've got a problem with. If there's somewhere contained in the Act that you were talking about, it was way before my time. It might be so, but then just let us know where and what that specific act entails. Otherwise, we're putting something in here that I see, we're just putting it to be nice and there's no way to regulate it.
Can you look at that act again, the Mercenary Act and the Assistance, Foreign Military Assistance Act as well? Because I remember this debate, vaguely I remember, it's many moons ago, but I remember this debate. And I think there is provision in one of those acts, I can't remember which one.
Chair, the gap is really that I think the recruiting in South Africa is covered, etc. But in most of these instances, there's only a recruitment drive through the internet, for example. But certainly the person must know what job he's being applying for, etc. And this is really to fill that gap of a person responding to an internet advert, actually it can be an armed guarding service, but once you perform an armed guarding service in a country of conflict, for example, then it becomes regulated and then you need permission in terms of the Foreign Military Assistance Act. So I think this is really, and this emanated from recommendations that were made in the Defense Portfolio Committee when the legislation was considered there. And we were actually instructed to look at how can we fill this gap of persons recruited in South Africa. And I don't think we want to criminalize the person recruiting from outside. But it's a matter of that there must be knowledge that this person is being recruited and it's for security services and outside the Republic. And then we can cross-check as well and make sure that it's not a country of conflict and all that type of stuff. And I think there is some, the Secretary has mentioned that the information can be reported to the State Security Agency. But there's also a police involvement to a certain extent to this, in the sense of the crimes possibly being committed if it's in a country of armed conflict, etc. But I'm satisfied that the reporting can be to the State Security Agency and that there can be a refinement before one would start investigating a criminal offence or something.
Mr. Stewart.
Chair, if there's a case, then and the person is obliged to adhere to this, then there must be a penalty somewhere if he doesn't adhere to this. There must be a penalty. Otherwise, why are we putting it in?
I agree with you. Is it there? Okay. There is one apparently. But can I ask that you go and just look at the two acts that we refer to? I don't have a problem with this. I think it is very important that it be, you know, Mr. Stuber, I was part of a delegation that observe the Comoros elections. And our defense force was deployed there. And I can tell you that I don't think a quarter of those guys came back, because they were recruited there and then to do these kinds of things. On the basis. On the basis they were recruited. That's the reality of the matter. And I think this becomes important, because it is also impacting on, for instance, our engineers working up in Africa in a conflict area. And because of South Africans' involvement in these kinds of things, they get targeted, because immediately when they're there, they're seen as part of these security guys, even if that's not what they're doing. And we've seen deaths as a result of it. So I don't have a problem. I hear what the Honourable Stewart is saying. That's why I say let's just go and look at it. I mean, you're not going to... If you're going to leave the country not knowing what you're going to do, then it becomes human trafficking, quite frankly. So surely you should be knowing what you are going to do in another country, I hope. Can we continue?
Thank you, Chair. Then on page 69, the offences and penalties. Just a deletion in 2 sub B.
Sorry, I'm going to stop you right here now, because I want us to finish at 6:15. It's 22, it's no sense trying to continue with that. Can we start page 69 tomorrow? We'll start on page 69. We're almost through the bill. I think we've actually made good progress, despite the issues that are still there. Members, the adoption of the two reports, because of the fact that there were confusion, and also the fact that members only got the IPED report this morning, I'm going to make the arrangement that we adopt starting 2 o'clock tomorrow. We're meeting in G26 so that we can be close to the National Assembly. Yeah, that's what I say. G26 is right behind the Speaker's chair. We're meeting there so that if we need to go and vote, that we can go and vote. We're starting with the adoption of the 2 BRR reports, the one on SAPS, the Secretariat, and the one on IPED. I'm literally going to go and say page by page. We're definitely not going to go through in more detail than that, because members will then have had time to go through everything. So please have a look, so that we can adopt it tomorrow afternoon. And then immediately after, we'll continue with the bill. The department, the technical team, CIRA, State Law Advisors can join us at 2 o'clock. This is not going to take longer than half an hour for us to do if we do it properly. Sorry? Balboa and Urban has given me nightmares yesterday. They mustn't give me nightmares again today, please. You want to deal with it now? I would have preferred if we could have dealt with IPED now. I'm just worried in terms of time. I mean, this BRR report is not thin of SAPS. Let's do it the other problem is that Mr. Ndlovu, for instance, didn't get his yesterday, only got it this morning. So I think at that stage this empowers him to make his input as well. So we start at 2 o'clock, G26, and if necessary, members, we will sit until 7 o'clock. We're not meeting on Friday. And for that reason, we sit as long as we need to sit tomorrow to finish the work, please. I want to make sure that by tomorrow we have gone through the bill at least once and gone back to those issues that we said you must look at for tomorrow. There are issues that you must look at for next week. Members, thank you very much. Department, thank you. People who need transport, it will be 5:45. Babella, the transport will be way down. Okay. 5:45, it will be there. Okay, thank you very much. Meeting is adjourned.